Aren't you the bold one? The tall Frey took a step closer, and Wraith realized that they were the same height. Wraith glared back, refusing to blink. So, you're a great warrior, then. Do you think you could kill me? He didn't reply. The Frey was sizing him up, and Wraith wanted to keep him ignorant. There are stories about you all along the road. I'm a little disappointed. I expected you'd be taller. The tails certainly are. The others laughed. Do you know who I am? The tall, long-haired Frey held his hands out, palms up, and slowly pivoted to give Wraith a full view. Sun glared off his brilliant armor, and the wind blew his golden hair. I'm Nephron, son of Zephron, leader of the Instaria tribe, and captain of the Galantians, these nice fellows with me. They are the elite of the Instaria, and as there are no greater warriors than the Frey, these Galantians are the best of the best. Being their leader, I suppose that makes you the best of the best of the best. Wraith spoke with a cavalier tone. He wanted to show he wasn't impressed, which was difficult since he was certain the Frey told the truth. Nephron shook his head. No, I'm actually not. He clapped the short-haired Frey's shoulder. Sebek is. This brought a round of moans from the rest of the troop. Well, okay, each of us has specific fields of expertise, but... He paused, holding up a finger and glancing at the others. I'd still say Sebek is the best overall warrior. Anyone dispute that? Sebek grinned. No one said a word. Nephron returned his focus to Wraith. I suppose you think you're something special, now that you've killed one of us, yes? Before you get too full of yourself, look at the sword you carry. See all the fancy decorations on the hilt? The encrusted gems? Lovely, isn't it? Do you think that's a warrior's weapon? Shigan was a member of the Ansendwar tribe, the hunter. They provide food for our kind, although they're skilled trackers and excellent in forests and fields. They don't know much about real combat. The sword is merely decorative. A pretty toy. He received it as a gift from an admirer. Some idiot in Astramnidon who doesn't know the first thing about battle made it. Nephron drew his sword. He did it slowly, making a point not to threaten. Nevertheless, Wraith took a step back and gripped the hilt of his weapon more tightly. This, he presented his weapon, is Pontifex, one of the names we have for the wind. It's a custom-crafted, curved cleave I designed myself. Simple, short, and fast. Not as austere as Sebek's more traditional twins, but, as you can see, it's definitely not a toy. So tell me, Rune, do you think you can kill me? I'm not a rune. I'm a man. Nephron smiled. The cheery, simple look disturbed Wraith more than anything that had happened so far. He didn't know what it meant. Let's find out exactly what you are. Go ahead. Draw that pretty sword. Nephron waited until Wraith had his blade clear. And your shield. Slip it on. We need to do this right. Wraith wasn't certain if it was a trick. The Frey saw his apprehension and took a step back, providing him room to safely arm himself. That's an odd shield, Sebek said, and glanced at Nephron. Did Shigan have a weird little decorative derg shield? Nephron shrugged. Who knows? The Galantian leader also had a shield, and in one blindingly fast motion it moved from his back to his forearm. The action was beyond impressive, like magic. Wraith couldn't help being intimidated. even as he realized that had been the point. The rest of the fray stepped back, and when they were both ready, Nephron bowed while touching the sword's pommel to his forehead. Wraith returned only a nod. He expected the same lethal speed as before, and wasn't disappointed. Nephron was faster than Shigon, but not exceedingly so. If Wraith hadn't already faced a fray, if he hadn't seen the lightning-quick strikes before, he would have been dead in an instant. But Wraith was ready this time. He devoted himself to instinct and caught the stroke with his new shield. He had no idea what to expect and was shocked when the power of Nephron's blow rang the metal and jarred the buckler from his grip. With no supporting strap, it fell to the grass. "No protection," Sebek muttered. "Just decorative." A following stroke was inevitable. Wraith acted in anticipation rather than in reaction. Nephron struck, aiming to decapitate him. If Wraith had been an instant slower, he would have lost his head. His blade clashed with Nephron's, and Wraith feared a repeat of his failure with his father's copper, but as the metals kissed, Shigon's weapon, toy or not, held. Nephron wasn't one to pause. Momentum was in his favor, and he pressed hard, striking again, first low, then high. Wraith caught the strokes an instant before they would have cleaved off his leg and arm. He had no time to counterattack as the fray forced his advantage. "He's fast. So incredibly fast." Wraith's brothers weren't this quick. They were brutes, big and heavy. Wraith was the swiftest among them, and he used that to his advantage. If they caught him, Wraith was beat, so he perfected his ability to dodge. Speed had made all the difference in the past, speed and balance, but Nephron was better at both. Stretched to his limit, Wraith fell back, holding on to life by his fingertips, as he managed to barely place his sword in the path of Nephron's hammering. The blades had no time to stop singing before the next toll sounded. Defeat was inevitable. Wraith only needed to make one mistake, and it wasn't long before he did. The fray's sword came across in a blinding sweep, and Wraith battered it aside, but with too much force. He lost precious time recovering his balance, and wouldn't be able to catch the next stroke. From somewhere behind Wraith came a gasp of fear. He wasn't the only one to see what was coming. In anticipation of the killing blow, he gritted his teeth. Miraculously, Nephron slowed. The fray looked up, distracted by something near the doll's gate, something behind Wraith. The lack of concentration was brief, but enough. Knowing he couldn't counter Nephron's attack, Wraith didn't bother. Instead, he made a dangerous gamble. For the first time, Wraith went on the offensive. He swung down instead of across. They would trade blows, blood for blood. The move might have worked, but the fray raised his shield. Another first. Before his stroke was through, Wraith was already shifting for his next. He had the upper hand now, and intended to keep it. Spinning, Wraith cut upward. Nephron was forced to dodge. Again and again, Wraith pressed his attack, knowing he couldn't allow the fray to catch his composure or the tide would turn again. Wraith hammered his opponent, desperate to weaken the strength in Nephron's arm. Sweat formed on the fray's brow, and his gleaming eyes weren't so bright. Remembering his brother's tactics, Wraith moved in close to mitigate the fray's ability to dart clear of attacks. When he saw his chance, Wraith stomped down hard on his opponent's foot. Surprise flashed on Nephron's face, and Wraith took the opportunity to punch him hard in the jaw with the hilt of Shigon's sword. The Galantian staggered backward, stunned and off balance. Blood dripped from his chin, and his shield lowered. Seeing his one clear chance to win, Wraith stabbed out. Clang! Wraith's attack was parried away. A second stroke hit the hilt of Shigon's sword, breaking Wraith's grip and throwing the weapon to the ground. Sebek stood before him, holding a cleave in each hand, violence in his eyes. Bold, confident, powerful. Despite Malcolm's assurances, Wraith believed that what stood before him was indeed a god. He waited, but Sebek didn't advance. He merely stood with one foot on Shigon's sword. Nephron was bent over, panting for breath and wiping blood and sweat from his eyes. Wraith, also struggling for air, took a step back and drew his father's hunting knife. It wasn't much, but it was slightly better than Herkimer's broken blade. Of course. How fitting that I'll die holding the same knife. The gods are nothing if not poetic. Nephron waved a dismissive hand at them both. We're done. What does "we're done" mean? Is this where they kill me? Wraith didn't mind the break. He needed a rest. The chance to clear his eyes and take in much-needed air was welcome. Waiting for what would come next, Wraith glanced behind him to see what had distracted Nephron. Persephone and Malcolm stood together, watching wide-eyed from the open gate. Persephone had hands over her mouth. Malcolm appeared just as apprehensive, but managed to offer Wraith an approving smile. How did you learn to fight like that? Nephron asked.
My father taught me.
Your father? He glanced over at Sebek. Did you see?
Sebek nodded.
Hard not to.
My father fought in the High Spear campaigns, Wraith explained. He was taught by your people.
He wasn't taught by my people, Nephron said. He was taught by my father. Those are his techniques.
Wraith didn't know what to say. He decided nothing was the best course and focused on breathing. Whatever came next, he would need air.
Why did you do it? Nephron asked, and then spit a bit of blood. Why did you kill Shigon? Was it for sport? To see if you could? To test your mettle?
Wraith shook his head. I thought you heard the stories. He killed my father.
That was true.
Nephron looked surprised.
Killed him right in front of me.
Nephron stared hard at Wraith, and for another long moment no one moved or spoke. Then the Frey nodded, as if understanding something.
Thing is, Shigon was a Bredithine mare.
I've heard that about him, Wraith said.
If it wasn't forbidden, I'd have killed him centuries ago.
Nephron ran an absent hand through his long hair and looked at the sword beneath Sebek's boot.
Give it back to him. He's earned it.
We're going again, then? Wraith asked.
No.
Nephron held up his free hand as he sheathed his sword.
I found out what I wanted to know.
Which was?
That it's possible.
What is?
For a rune to kill a Frey.
Glad to have helped.
Can we come in now? Nephron asked.
Sorry. Wraith shook his head.
Not very courteous of you.
Neither is slaughtering thousands of people and burning down Dorea and Nadak.
Nephron nodded.
You make a good point.
But would it make a difference if I told you we...
He gestured toward his group. I had nothing to do with that. In fact, we're outlaws. Rebels. Because we refused to take part in that reprehensible affair. We went against the edicts of our ruler and declined to butcher defenseless runes. We're in flight, like you. And from the same pursuers.
If you have been offered shelter, couldn't we receive the same?
Wraith was stunned. He had imagined the conversation going differently.
It's not my decision to make. He turned to look at Persephone again. She blinked, then nodded.
It would appear the lady approves, Wraith said. Welcome to Dalren.
Wonderful, Nephron smiled. Where is Macus?
Macus?
He's the leader here, right?
This time Persephone spoke from the shelter of the open gate.
Chieftain Macus was... That is, he is dead. He's been dead for, 70 years, I think. He was my husband's great-great-grandfather.
Oh, Nephron said.
Well, do you still make that marvelous wine?
The pale red one with a hint of nuts? I've boasted about it all the way here.
There was a vineyard once, up on the slope of the Horn Ridge, Persephone said, but it was lost to drought decades ago.
Nephron scowled.
Doesn't anything in this place last?
Hardship, Persephone replied. We always have an abundance of that.
The god looked directly at her. Their eyes met, and he smiled. With a nod, he replied,
Well, at least you have that.
Chapter 11 The Tutor. There were 7 clans of the Rulin runes, and 3 for the Gula runes. Each clan had a chieftain. When it was necessary to unite, a single leader was named, and we called him the Kenig, which eventually became the word king. The Frey had tribes instead of clans, and no chieftains. Instead, they had a single ruler, who was called the Fane. The Book of Brin.
The 3 stones clattered to the marble floor. One rolled toward Arion, who picked it up and handed the smooth, egg-sized rock back to Mwan Delay. The Fane's son acted as if the little stone weighed a ton, every movement dramatizing extreme effort. Even his breathing appeared labored, each exhalation a long sigh. He stood before her, frowning, head bowed and shoulders slumped so that the sleeves of his assegai slipped down and covered his hands.
"I can't do it," he told her.
"Try again," Arion insisted.
"I don't want to."
The 2 were in the palace's entrance hall, which Arion had chosen for its high ceiling. She'd chased away the servants to give them privacy, and it was there before the grand staircase, and among the lavish frescoes, tapestries, polished stone, and vases filled with flowering plants, that the 2 faced off in a battle of wills.
"I don't care. Do it anyway."
Arion folded her arms in a gesture that should have ended the debate, but this was no typical student of the art. Mwan Delay was the prince, the 25-year-old son of Fane Lothian, and every one of those years had been spent isolated in the Tolwara palace. Surrounded by servants and those eager to curry favor, the prince had developed an inflated sense of himself. He glared back defiantly, his anger unmistakable. Most people wouldn't risk antagonizing the son of the only Frey endowed by the god Ferol with the power to kill or order the death of another of their kind. But being too lenient wouldn't help Mwan Delay or the future of their people. After spending time with him, Arion was sure Fane Fenelaus wanted her grandson schooled in more than just the art, and she was going to do exactly that.
"You may be the prince," she thought, "but I've lived more than 2,000 years. Which well do you think goes deeper?"
If she was going to teach him anything, she had to establish respect. As far as Arion knew, the only person Mwan Delay held any respect for, other than his father, was First Minister Grendel. Not a surprise, Grendel was a legend and held in awe by nearly every Mirrorleaf.
Arion didn't waver. She stood with folded arms, staring directly back. After several minutes, the prince's ire turned to bafflement. Servants, who'd been with him since birth, weren't likely to lock eyes with him for long. This was only their third meeting, his second lesson, and the prince was testing her boundaries. Centuries of meditation and training gave her a considerable edge. Arion didn't so much as blink. The prince struggled to mimic her resolve. The lad was stubborn, if nothing else. That was good. It showed a strength of character. She could work with that. In the stillness of their silent war, Arion could hear the rustle of leaves and the songs of birds entering an open window, accompanied by a pleasant spring breeze. Deeper in the palace, she could make out the muffled music of the Estremnadon choir, practicing for their performance before the fane. She settled in for a long battle and focused on her breathing, each inhalation and exhalation evenly paced. Arion was just becoming comfortable when Wanderlei's glare wavered. The prince huffed, and with a scowl picked the stones up again, two in one hand, one in the other. He threw the first, but with too much force. Arion was grateful she had insisted on practicing under the high ceiling of the entrance hall. Wanderlei quickly threw the second stone, too quickly. The height and timing were both off. "Is he really so inept, or feigning incompetence out of defiance?" The stones came down like projectiles, and Wanderlei chose to dodge rather than catch. She didn't criticize his reluctance. From such a height, the rocks would hurt. The stones hit the floor again with loud cracks.
"See?"
Wanderlei shouted, putting hands on hips. He pursed his lips so tightly that they went white.
"Yes, yes, I see. You've proved me wrong. That's wonderful. Now, if you'd actually juggle the stones, I'd appreciate that even more."
"It's stupid.
And I don't see what this has to do with the art."
He hummed, and with the tension-filled flick of his fingers, the stones rose and chased one another in a circle, like a wheel spinning in the air.
"Why should I use my hands when I can already do this with the art? Your lessons make no sense."
"Yes, you're very clever, but that isn't today's lesson," she said.
Arion picked up a wine glass from a nearby table. She'd been enjoying the light, delicate ambrosia while waiting for the prince. The glass was empty, except for a dry red ring at the bottom.
"Catch," she said, and tossed it at Wanderlei.
"What?"
Panic flashed across his face. The prince reached out with his control hand, and the crystal goblet bounced off his fingers. He tried to make a grab with the other, almost had it, but the glass slipped away, as did the stones. Everything struck marble. The stones clattered, the glass shattered.
Arion mused, tapping her upper lip. "Something seems to have gone wrong there, didn't it?"
"Yeah, you threw a glass at me."
"Imagine if it had been a knife, a javelin, or a ball of fire. And instead of stones, what if those rocks were people's lives?"
She looked down at the mess at his feet.
"Perhaps if you had learned how to concentrate on more than one thing at a time, they wouldn't all be dead right now."
"Arion," the boy said, looking down, "they aren't people, they're stones."
"Lucky for you.
Or should I say, lucky for them?
Now pick up those poor dead bodies and try again."
"And the glass? That was—"
Arion coughed, and the 8 large pieces, 17 shards, and 2,374 grains of powdered dust leapt off the floor and reassembled themselves into a glass sitting on the table, perfectly restored.
Even the residue stain remained.
Whoa!
Mandalay stared at the goblet.
How did you do that?
By paying attention when others were teaching me and not questioning their methods. The prince contemplated this. His eyes shifted between the glass and the stones while he rubbed the stubble on his head. Like all Miraleth, Mandalay shaved his head, but it had been a few days, and a dark shadow was forming. Arion couldn't understand how he could allow that. She couldn't go 2 days without shaving. It didn't feel clean. As Mandalay bent to pick up the stones, the doors of the grand entrance burst open and boomed as they banged against the walls. Arion didn't need to look to know who it was. Grendel's aversion to touching doors bordered on obsession. He avoided touching most things, preferring to cultivate lavish fingernails long enough to curl. Instead, he used the art to punch doors open and always overdid it. Arion knew the excessive force wasn't due to a lack of skill or control, just one of Grendel's many idiosyncrasies. His issue with doors was among the least peculiar. Grendel didn't offer so much as a glance in their direction as he marched across the hall. The jingling of tiny chains draped between piercings in his ears, cheeks, and nose accompanied each step. A long golden cape flowed in his wake. Arion rolled her eyes. Grendel was using the art to summon a breeze to make his mantle billow. He maintained a second weave to enhance its color, which was brighter than any dye could achieve. Mandalay had a different reaction. He watched the First Minister with wide-eyed eagerness. As Grendel passed them without breaking his stride, he barked out,
"You, follow!
Do you think he means you,
or me?"
Mandalay asked Arion, unable to contain his excitement.
"I suppose we should find out."
"Go on. You won't be able to concentrate now anyway." The boys sprinted after the First Minister, toward the throne room. Arion bent down, picked up the rocks, and placed them in her satchel. Although ordinary, the stones were the same ones she'd learned with. Arion kept few keepsakes, but these were three of her most prized. She had hoped they would somehow make things easier with the prince by instilling the same sense of wonder in him as mastering them had in her. So far, things weren't going as she'd hoped. When she looked up, Mandalay was already out of sight. Arion sighed. Grendel was a tough act to compete against. As the winner of the Grantheum Art Tournament each year, as far back as anyone could recall, he was the idol of every Miraleth. Arion was in the minority. She couldn't say she cared for him. Although Fenelaus hadn't mentioned anything, Arion suspected that the old Fane had shared Arion's opinion.
"I wonder what she would have made of Trilos."
Who or what he was remained a puzzle. She hadn't seen him since that one meeting, and even though she inquired about him everywhere she went, no one had heard of anyone by that name. Her failed efforts to unmask the stranger deepened the mystery to the point that she almost doubted the encounter altogether. Arion caught up to the pair outside the throne room. Even Grendel didn't dare blast open that door, but she was surprised he had waited for her.
"Your flawless magnificence, I have news," Grendel said to the closed doors, and a moment later they opened.
Grendel entered, his cape whipping like the tail of a cat, nervous about getting it caught. Arion and Mandalay followed. The throne room was precisely that, a room for the throne. The chamber needed to be massive because the forest throne consisted of 6 extremely old and intertwined trees of different varieties, each representing one of the 6 original tribes of the Frey. A mass of roots formed the room's floor, and the ceiling was an impenetrable canopy of branches and leaves. The Fane's chair predated everything except the door. The forest throne was the second oldest thing in Erevan, and perhaps the world. The room, the whole palace, had come later.
"Your Majesty, a bird has arrived with confirmation from Alanrist on the matter of Nephron and his Galantians,"
Grindel said. He and Mwandule stood at the foot of the forest throne, where Fane Lothian sat listening.
"They have indeed refused to obey your edict and assaulted Petragar before escaping to the wilderness of Rulin."
"How is Petragar? Did they kill him?"
the Fane asked.
"The Frey's supreme ruler, and divinely chosen voice of the god Ferol, sat with one leg over the tendril arm of the magnificent throne, absently strumming a seven-string velor.
The great chamber wasn't designed for music, and the soft notes were lost to the expanse, making weak, wistful sounds.
Fane Lothian wore a green robe and the familiar gold-cast circlet of leaves, the same one that had graced Fenelaus's head for as long as Arion had lived. Seeing it on his bald head, she conceded Fenelaus's argument that hair had its beauty.
"No," Grindel reported. "Petragar's alive, but seriously injured."
"So where are they now?"
"Unknown. I don't expect they'll return to Alanrist. Not on their own, that is. They'll have to be brought to justice."
Lothian sighed.
"I didn't want it to be this way."
"Excuse me, my Fane, but I'm a bit lost," Arion said. "Exactly what are we talking about?"
"Nephron, son of Zephron, was the commander at the Alanrist frontier outpost."
"Son of Zephron? The Instaria who challenged you for the throne?"
Lothian nodded. "I doubted his son would give me his unwavering loyalty, so I replaced him with Petragar. Nephron took the change worse than I expected."
"Indeed, after beating the new commander bloody, he deserted,"
Grendel added.
"That's horrible," Arion said. "I had no idea conditions out there had become so atrocious."
"Few do," Grindel told her. "And we need to keep it that way. All these centuries stationed on the borderlands, all these years living among savages, has bred dissent among the Instaria. They have grown wild and insubordinate, and the Galantians are the worst example of this. They're more Rune than Frey now."
Arion frowned as she noticed how Mwandule stood with hands grasped behind his back in the same stance as Grendel.
"Uncivilized barbarians."
Grendel's usual voice could make "good morning" sound like a death sentence, but he spoke now with even greater brutality. Arion thought Grendel saw himself as the epitome of culture. Dark eye makeup, half a dozen facial piercings, and an obsession with wearing only gold, were all attempts to demonstrate his refinement. As fastidious as he was about his appearance, the art was his true addiction. Fenelaus had warned about the temptation to overindulge.
"Power has a way of seducing by saying what you want to hear. Remember, it's easier to believe an outlandish lie confirming what you suspect than the most obvious truth that denies it,"
the old Fane had said.
"Such insubordination is dangerous to leave unchecked, my Fane. I advocate execution,"
Grendel said. Lothian considered this, then shook his head.
"I don't agree. They only beat Petragar, they didn't kill him. If they had crossed that line..."
"They haven't crossed it. Yet. Are you willing to take such a risk?"
"I may be the Fane, but I still need justification. Ferol's law grants me the power, but I must be judicious in its use."
Grendel looked irritated, more so than usual. Seeing any expression beneath all the rings and chains was difficult. Arion suspected that he walked carefully through the thickets of the garden, so he didn't catch the hoops or chains on any branches.
Maybe that's the point. His way of displaying he's above such mundane concerns.
Given the length of his fingernails, he certainly couldn't juggle her rocks, or, she smiled, open doors.
Ferrol's law was created for ordinary Frey, not the Mirrorleith, Grendel said. The art has elevated us, and we cannot be bound by the law of a god when we have become gods ourselves.
Arion saw Moandelay nodding, a look of wonder and admiration in his eyes.
He would be the next Fane.
And it was her responsibility to make sure he was a good ruler. She stepped forward.
How wonderful! I wasn't aware we had achieved divinity. When exactly did that happen?
Her tone caught them all by surprise.
And now that we have, she continued, please tell me when we'll be having tea with Brother Ferrol. My mother would love his recipe for vegetable soup. As for myself, I'd like some advice on how to create my own race of people, for that ability has eluded me.
Grendel's chains rattled as he turned to glare, his look so venomous that she prepared to weave a shield. He wasn't beyond abusing his power. There were those who accused Grendel of excessive violence during tournaments, and told stories of him using the art in romantic encounters. One ex-lover claimed their tryst had resulted in her death and resurrection, which proved that not all the rumors were true. Still, Arion once had seen Grendel torture another Frey, a simple Gwaedrae farmer. As far as she could tell, he'd done so for the thrill, seeing how far he could go without killing the man. Not unlike holding one's own hand close enough to a flame to almost burn.
Grendel didn't mean it that way, Lothian said.
A flip of his hand revealed how oblivious the Fane was to the cataclysmic eruption pending only 3 feet away.
But he makes a valid point. Mirrorleith are a breed above everyone else. It's foolish and outdated to think otherwise. We might not be gods, but compared with the other tribes, we might as well be.
Then we should seek to be benevolent gods. Yes?
Arion said.
Treat other tribes the way we would like Ferrol to treat us.
Exactly, Lothian said. We have a responsibility to our own, and the Instaria are monsters of our making. They want to return. Did you know that?
You can't allow it.
Grendel said, reluctantly pulling his gaze away from Arion.
They can't hope to assimilate into Frey society any more than a rune could. They would be a terrible disruption.
Arion noticed how the First Minister used the term Frey as if it no longer applied to himself.
Come now, Grendel, it's not quite as bleak as all that, the Fane said. Runes are vile, filthy beings living in makeshift dwellings of dirt and rocks. They wallow in their own waste.
You've seen them?
Moandelay asked excitedly.
You've crossed the Nidwalden River?
Yes, once. Many centuries ago.
You left Erevan?
Arion asked.
Why would you do that?
My mother required it. During the Dark War, she wanted me along to see it for myself.
And you saw a rune?
Moandelay asked again.
The Fane chuckled.
Not a rune, many runes. They multiply at a ridiculous rate. A single female can give birth to a brood. Some others have as many as 12 or 14 offspring.
14?
Arion said, shocked.
Yes. Well, not at one time. At least I don't think,
Lothian explained.
But they have been known to bear a single litter of 2 or 3, possibly more.
There must be thousands,
Arion said.
Tens of thousands.
Lothian corrected.
We actually don't know how many.
Are they dangerous? Wanderlei asked.
No more than any other animal,
Lothian said.
In fact, a bear or big cat is far worse. The runes are terrified of us. They would scatter if we came near.
You are correct, my Fane, Grendel said. I shouldn't have grouped the Instaria so easily with the runes. But it doesn't change the fact that centuries among the barbarians have made the Instaria unfit for Frey society. Similarly, I don't think the Instaria at Elenrist are capable of dealing with Nephron and his Galantians.
So you have no confidence in Petrogar,
the Fane added. Grendel looked at Lothian as if he'd made a bad joke.
Nephron is dangerous, my Fane, and one of your best warriors. I think you would be wise to send a Mirrorleith.
The Instaria revere Nephron and his Galantians. The longer they avoid judgment, the greater the risk becomes they could fuel a rebellion, as we saw with Zephron.
But that wasn't a rebellion, Arion said.
Zephron followed the law and acquired permission from the Aquila to blow the horn of Glyndora and challenge for the throne.
It was legal, Lothian told her, but it revealed a mindset, a propensity for dissent against the rule of the Mirrorleaf that I don't appreciate.
I'll go,
Wanderlei announced, eyes shifting between his father and Grendel.
I'll bring this Nephron back on a leash.
The frontier is no place for a child, Lothian declared.
I'm not a child.
This united them all in a smile, all except Wanderlei.
Actually, this is why I invited you to this meeting, Arion. I think you should be sent to subdue this artless rebel,
Grendel said. Arion was stunned and not at all pleased.
I have responsibilities here. I need to continue Mondelez's lessons. He's woefully behind.
I can fill in for you,
Grendel said. The delight on Mondelez's face was unmistakable.
Besides, as tutor to the next Fane, wouldn't you agree that crossing the Nidwalden and seeing the greater world would enhance your ability to educate the prince?
A good argument. Too good.
She didn't have a response.
It shouldn't take long,
Grendel assured, most likely to preempt any objection.
Certainly not for one such as you.
I don't see how I'm any better suited than any other Mirrorleith,
Arion said.
You're too modest. Were you not handpicked by the great Fenelaus to be Mwanderlei's tutor? And didn't she bestow upon you the honorific of Senslaw? Surely you possess talents that impressed her. Why else would she choose you over me? Here is your chance to utilize such skills.
He's maneuvering me out of the way.
What she didn't know was how long Grendel had been planning the move. The comment about Fenelaus choosing her over him was troubling. He hadn't shown any interest in teaching the prince, but that didn't mean he hadn't been harboring resentment. Arion had the nagging sense that she ought to resist the invitation, but Lothian was nodding with a smile in her direction. The decision had been made already, and her opinion no longer mattered.
Chapter 12. Gods Among Us. Although I still see the days of my youth as warm and sunny, I realize now that before the gods came, life on the Dol was a monotonous routine of drudgery. Afterward, nothing was the same. The Book of Brin.
"What are they doing now?"
Moya asked Brin, who peered through the open door of the roundhouse.
"Where are they?"
"Haven't moved. Still in front of the lodge steps. They're setting up a little camp, laying out beds for the night. I only count 8, though. One's missing."
They were all in Roan's home.
Although no smaller than Sarah's roundhouse, it felt cramped, stuffed with all manner of things, including piles of antlers, string, branches, stones, boxes, tusks, bones, sticks, reeds, plants, and an abandoned beehive. Since returning, Persephone no longer felt comfortable imposing on Sarah's hospitality. Her husband, Delwyn, had appeared less than enthusiastic at the prospect of their one guest turning into five. It certainly didn't help that one was a Duraean, another a wolf, the third a mystic, the fourth an ex-slave from Alan Rist, and that Persephone had been accused of murder. In contrast, Rhone and Moya were delighted to have them. Rhone even rushed out and enlisted Padera's help to fix their meal. Rhone hadn't entertained before and was clueless about what to do. She wanted everything to be perfect.
"The missing one is probably up on the wall somewhere," Malcolm said. "The Instaria are a militant group and always post a sentry."
"The gods are making beds?" Moya asked.
"Yes," Bryn said, acting as everyone's eyes and ears. "One's setting up a fire, two others are sharpening weapons."
"So, gods sleep?"
Moya asked, no one in particular.
"They aren't gods," Malcolm said. "Actually, they're not much different from us. Some think the Frey, Durg, and Runes are all related."
"Like from the same clan?"
Persephone asked.
"Originally, yes."
Wraith, who was sitting on the floor beside Malcolm, Suri, Mina, and a goat's skull, offered a sour chuckle.
"We're nothing alike."
Malcolm smirked.
"You're worldlier than I thought. Met a number of each, have you?"
Wraith replied with a scowl and shifted the goat's skull to clear a few more inches of room.
"I have,"
Persephone said. "And although being from the same clan does seem to be a bit of a stretch, I can see the point. There are a lot of similarities." She sat in one of the net swings that dangled from the roundhouse's main support beam. Hanging chairs, Rhone called them. Rhone had a habit of making unusual things, and her home, in addition to resembling an overstuffed squirrel's nest, was a showcase of oddities. The house had been built by Ivar the Carver, who had been a part-time peddler. As a result, the place was always filled with a scattered assortment of trinkets. Having been Ivar's slave since birth, Rhone had grown up as one more bit of scrap. Ivar had died the previous winter, and Rhone was still trying to figure out life as a free woman. Moya had moved in with her a few weeks after Ivar's death. Given Moya's outgoing nature, everyone expected her to be a positive influence on the shy ex-slave, and Rhone did seem a little better, but the improvement hadn't extended to the house. Neither Rhone nor Moya, it turned out, could be called tidy. The only thing not in abundance was floor space.
"How are we similar?" Wraith asked.
Persephone shrugged.
"Well, we all sleep.
I wouldn't think a god would have need for that."
"So do rabbits."
"Yeah, but rabbits don't wear clothes, have language, or use tools."
Moya nodded in agreement. She, too, was in a hanging chair and was using both hands to sip tea from one of Gifford's beautifully crafted ceramic cups. His creations were delicate, perfect works of art that everyone treated with care.
"What about Conniger, Bryn? Any movement from the lodge?"
"Both doors still closed,"
the girl replied with professional brevity.
"I'm going to have to go up there," Persephone declared.
"Why?"
Moya and Wraith said together, each with the same shocked tone.
"I have to tell Conniger what's going on. He's the chieftain and needs to know. Can't imagine what he's thinking with 9 Frey on his doorstep."
7, Bryn corrected. 7 Frey, 1 giant, and I can't tell what the other one is."
"What is that 9th one?"
Wraith asked Malcolm. "Do you know?"
"Goblin,"
Padera said. The old farmer's wife was deftly working on the glowing coal bed in the fire pit. She was boiling water in a suspended skin sack and showing Roan how to bake bread wrapped in soaked leaves.
Goblin?
Moya leaned over, dangling precariously in her swing, and trying to look out the door Bryn was holding open.
How can you see anything with those old, tired peepers of yours?
Persephone had wondered the same thing. The old woman's squinting eyes were so lost in the folds, creases, and wrinkles of her mushed melon face that they all but vanished. When Padera spoke, one, and only one, would pop open with a powerful glare, while the other squeezed tight as if she were taking aim. At that moment, the old woman had her sight on Moya.
These old eyes can still thread a needle faster than you can explain why you're hanging there and dangling your breasts in front of two men.
Moya scowled and sat back in her swing. I don't think you should go near the lodge, Wraith told Persephone. Before the fray showed up, your chieftain was siding against you. Didn't seem too happy afterward either.
Conniger isn't the problem, Persephone said. It's Hegna who's lying.
Maybe so, Moya said. But if Conniger wants to know what's going on, he can come out and talk to the Frey himself.
This shouldn't be about Conniger and what he should do or hasn't done, Persephone replied. For the good of the Dáil, the chieftain needs to know what is happening. Roan carried another Gifford cup of hot tea and handed it to Persephone.
Thank you, Roan.
Roan didn't reply. She just nodded and made her way back through the debris to where Padera was working over the pit fire.
I wish the Frey had accepted your invitation to stay in the lodge, Moya said, grinning mischievously over her drink. Can you imagine? Conniger having to move back into his family's house. He hates them, you know. Tressa has been bragging all over the Dáil about how wonderful it is to be out of that overcrowded pit.
When she was safely in the lodge, Tressa called Autumn and her husband pigs and said she didn't know how she managed to live there.
You really don't like him, do you? Persephone asked. What part of Conniger is making me marry the stump, don't you understand?
About time you married someone and stopped tempting every man from here to the blue sea, Padera said, slurring the words through toothless gums. You know, wars have started over women like you.
Moya scoffed.
You're so full of crap, old woman.
Bryn,
Padera called. Bryn tore her eyes away from the doorway.
Augusta of Melon, daughter of chieftain Earsol, started the Battle of the Red River when she refused to marry Theo of Warwick. When Theo's father was killed in the fight, Theo vowed vengeance and summoned all of Clan Warwick to his banner. This resulted in what became known as the 10-Year War, which claimed the lives of 1,000 men, and instigated a famine that lasted 2 years.
See, Padera said.
The old woman handed the dead chicken she'd brought with her to Roan.
Pluck it.
I'm sorry. Persephone sat up, making her seat rock. But I have to side with Moya on this one. Conniger is making her marry a man who tried to kill me.
Why is that? Padera asked, once more peering out at her with one eye.
I wish I knew, Persephone said.
I wouldn't say we're friendly, but I'm not aware of any ill will between us. I hadn't had any trouble with any of them until yesterday.
Roan, who stood next to Padera, struggled to yank feathers from the dead chicken, which she held by its feet. The old woman sighed. She took the dead bird and submerged it in the skin of water, which by then was boiling. She jiggled it vigorously up and down, waited a few seconds, pulled it out, and then submerged it again. The old woman did this several times, then plucked out a tail feather and smiled.
There, she said, handing the chicken back. Try it now.
Roan pulled the first feather, and it slipped free without effort.
You're a genius.
Padera grinned.
or more accurately, her eternal toothless frown stretched wider.
You're the genius. I'm just old. When you've raised 6 children, a husband, and dozens of cows, pigs, sheep, and who knows how many chickens, you learn a few things. Just remember, there's always a better way.
Roan nodded with fierce conviction, her eyes serious and focused, as if Padera had charged her with a crucial task.
There's always a better way. There's always a better way.
Well, if you have to go, I'll go with you, Wraith told Persephone. The big man stretched out his legs, which extended across a third of the room.
Thank you, but I'm not sure that's such a good idea.
If I bring you into the lodge, it might start a fight. She took a sip of tea.
You can't go up there alone.
Wasn't planning on it. I'll bring Delwyn, and maybe someone else I trust, like one of the farmers.
What are they going to do if he decides you're guilty and wants to execute you right there in the lodge? You might need someone who can fight.
Maybe that's how things are done in Dorea, but there's a process here. Our keeper of ways will insist.
Your keeper is a big man, is he?
A frail old woman, actually. But our chieftain respects our traditions and will listen to her. No one is executed without a public hearing.
Uh-huh. Sure. I'll be outside just in case. If you have trouble, yell.
Flattered by Wraith's concern, Persephone took a quick sip of tea to hide a self-conscious smile.
So, Bryn.
Moya leaned over the edge of her suspended netting. What happened? To the woman who started the war?
Bryn took a second to think, and her eyes shifted in focus.
After Theo of Warwick successfully besieged Dalmelin, he burned it and killed everyone she ever knew and a good deal of livestock. Then Augusta of Melin killed herself.
Oh,
Moya said, with a suddenly sour look.
Wraith? Malcolm? Padera barked. Fetch us some water. Take those empty gourds by the door.
Without a word, the two men got to their feet. Wraith bent low. The ceiling was too high for most to touch, but Wraith was tall, and there were plenty of plants, gourds, and fish hanging from the rafters to bang his head on. They grabbed the containers and headed out.
You sent Wraith to fetch water?
Persephone and Bryn asked in concert the moment the two had left.
Was just sitting there,
Padera replied.
But, the man saved us, and he's killed a god, Bryn declared,
crawling back toward the fire and rising to her knees in protest.
Then he ought to be able to handle carrying some water, don't you think?
The old woman fixed her with a one-eyed stare, and a misleading, toothless frown that Persephone knew to be a smile.
I can't believe how fortunate it was, running into him in the woods,
Moya said to Persephone. The young woman clutched the teacup to her breast. A wicked smile crossed her lips.
He's handsome. You're spoken for,
Bryn reminded her.
Shut up, will you?
Moya scowled, huffed, and slammed her head backward on the netting, making a thrum sound.
The stump can go hang himself. Got any spare rope, Roan?
Roan paused in her chicken plucking.
Of course I do. I always keep...
Moya sighed.
Roan, I'm not serious. Oh, sorry.
Don't need to apologize, Roan.
Sorry.
Moya sighed again.
Never mind.
Persephone loved Moya for her forthright, honest, speak-her-mind openness. She didn't know anyone who was braver or more helpful. But secretly, Persephone wondered if Conniger, Tressa, and Padera were right about Moya taking a husband. Not that she should be forced to marry the stump, but Moya, looking the way she did and refusing every proposal, had started fights among suitors. The gods had blessed her with beauty beyond mortal bounds, just as they had given mankind fire. Both gifts had the ability to leave destruction in their wake, but no one was foolish enough to swing a torch at every tree.
Moya, on the other hand, was an uncontrollable flirt and oblivious to the devastation she caused.
Bryn resumed her vigil at the door, her eyes intent on something.
"Wraith and Malcolm are at the well. The Frey doing anything?"
Moya sat up.
A couple looked over,